I'm Victor Sweezy, host of The Land in Between from the Global Reporting Center. Join us on a trip to the Republic of Georgia, a country at the crossroads of the EU and Putin's Russia. From the tear gas-filled streets of the capital to the manicured gardens of a billionaire oligarch, I'll take you to a critical moment in Georgia's history and explore what it means for the future of our world order. Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The first strikes were on Iran, but the war almost immediately became a regional conflict.
This war has escalated much quicker than a lot of us expected.
Fighting a stretch from the Mediterranean to the Indian Ocean. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, the breadth and scope of who's launching missiles at whom.
Also, the wild tale of a Portuguese fisherman who ran the cod industry like a mob boss.
When I arrived in the United States in 1968, I always said to myself, I am not going to be working for anybody else all my life.
Plus, Russia is giving Africans an alluring offer.
It sounds mouth-watering. Many people think it's something worth giving a chance.
But fighting in Russia's army comes with huge risks.
And South Korea takes on food waste today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. When the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran on Saturday, it started a war in the Middle East, but it has not stayed just there.
The conflict has now expanded farther into the region and beyond, into Asia. Iranian drones hit an airport in Azerbaijan today. Yesterday, NATO forces shot down a missile as it headed into Turkish airspace. And on Tuesday, U.S. forces sank an Iranian frigate in the Indian Ocean off of Sri Lanka. We begin today's show looking at the latest rings of expansion in this war. For that, we turn to Ali Vayas. He's the Iran Project Director at the International Crisis Group. When we spoke, I asked where the lines of the war map are currently drawn.
They are in a very wide geographic zone, stretching all the way from the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean Sea, because Iran has attacked, obviously, Israel, but there are also Iranian allies like Hezbollah in Lebanon, who are in a fight with Israel right now. There are Iraqi Shia militias that are targeting U.S. diplomatic and military facilities in Iraq. Iran itself is targeting the Persian Gulf countries, Azerbaijan in the north, Turkey in the northwest, all the way with Baluchi groups on Iranian borders with Pakistan are picking up arms. So this is spreading at a very high pace.
Is this spread part of the military strategy of the U.S., Israel, and or Iran, or is some of it an unintended consequence?
No, I do believe that it is part of the Iranian strategy. Iranians had threatened that if the U.S. and Israel attack them, that they would turn this into a regional conflagration.
Mm-hmm.
Iran, one has to understand, is a much weaker party compared to U.S. as the world's sole superpower, and Israel, which is also the region's most powerful army. And the way that it can impose a cost on U.S. and Israel is to expand the conflict both in space and time. If it basically expands it, it starts putting pressure on the global energy markets and stock markets, and even people in the U.S. or Europe would start feeling it at the gas station. And then you can also see that Iran is hoping that this would actually turn into an attritional conflict, because the longer it would take, the more they would be able to dictate the terms of how it would end, because they have a much higher threshold for pain than the U.S. and Israel.
The expansion beyond the Middle East has so far been pretty isolated regarding airstrikes. Should we understand this as new theaters of this conflict opening up, or just isolated incidents?
In Azerbaijan, for instance, the reason the Iranians are putting pressure there is because Azerbaijan has a good relationship with Israel, and the Iranians believe that it is helping Israel with intelligence collection. Also, Azerbaijan sends oil to Israel through a pipeline that passes through Turkey. Turkey houses a U.S. airbase, which is involved in the attacks. Turkey could also be dragged in another way, which is that apparently the U.S. and Israel are arming Iranian Kurds on the border between Iran and Iraq. Turkey has always been against Kurds gaining territory and becoming independent. The Gulf countries that have been targeted by Iran, they have responded in a defensive fashion so far. But it is possible that at some point they would also switch to offensive operations against Iran. On the eastern border with Pakistan, there are also Baluchi militias that are being armed and mobilized. And that would pose a security threat to Pakistan as well. So Pakistan could also be dragged into this. This is one of the reasons that it was quite reckless to start this war and thinking that the president would be able to control how it unfolds.
So would you say that war has already expanded beyond the Middle East, or is there just a risk that it could?
It certainly is a regional war at this moment, but it is not yet a extra-regional war in a serious way. But it always has that potential because, remember, this is only day six of this conflict, and it is starting to drag other countries in.
You've mentioned that the large part of the Iranian strategy is to disrupt global trade and the oil sector, pain points for much of the rest of the world. Historically, have disruptions like that drawn in countries farther afield from the Middle East, in Europe or Asia, for example?
Look, the Strait of Hormuz is a critical choke point for global energy. About 20% of the world's oil and gas pass through that strait every single day, and now it has been blocked for the past 3 days. There's another choke point on the other side of the Arabian Peninsula called Bab al-Mandab, which basically controls the entrance to the Red Sea. There you have an Iranian allied militia called the Houthis. They have not yet joined in, but it is quite possible, especially if Saudi Arabia and the UAE start targeting Iran, that they would also jump into this. Then we would have a situation that we've never seen before. Two critical choke points in the world being blocked at the same time. That is going to be devastating for countries like China and India that rely on these choke points for their energy imports.
The strike that has happened farthest from the Middle East is the sinking of the Iranian frigate in the Indian Ocean off of Sri Lanka. How significant do you see that as a marker of the expansion of this conflict?
That vessel was apparently close to Sri Lanka because it was doing some exercises with the Indian Army. I think the U.S. Navy probably saw it as an opportunity. But in any case, the Iranian Navy was never really a serious threat. We always knew that the most important threat that Iran poses at the naval level would be its speedboats and its underwater drones and anti-ship cruise missiles. And at this point, it is not clear if the U.S. has been able to neutralize those capacities or not.
Interesting. So just like their drones are quite effective in the air, they're also effective at sea.
Absolutely. And it is quite stunning, I have to admit, that despite the fact that in Ukraine we saw how drones could really become a game changer in a conflict, U.S. allies in the Gulf and even U.S. diplomatic or military facilities in the Gulf were not well prepared to counter the threat that these drones pose.
Is there a pathway to contain this war before it spreads much more?
President Trump can take an exit ramp whenever he decides to do so. He can already say that he has eliminated the Supreme Leader, he has degraded Iran's missile program, nuclear program, and so on. But at this point, it appears that both sides believe they can continue to turn the table against the other and they can still score points and don't seem to have an appetite for taking a step back.
You say that President Trump could end this whenever he wants. Isn't that also true for the Iranian leadership?
No, because they have to basically capitulate if they are to pull the plug on this. So the Iranian, you know, given the fact that they didn't start this aggression, they are very unlikely to end it.
Ali Vaez is the Iran Project Director at the International Crisis Group. Follow more of our reporting on the war at theworld.org.
Stepping back from war for now, We go to South Korea to hear about the country's unique approach to curbing food waste. In the United States, according to the USDA, roughly 133 billion pounds of food gets thrown away every year. 133 billion pounds per year. All that rotting food in landfills emits greenhouse gas. In South Korea, food waste gets recycled, but plenty of food still gets tossed. Authorities are trying to change that. Reporter Jason Strother has our story from Seoul.
It's garbage day, and my neighbors are carrying out their trash and recyclables to the street. Kim Sang-hee is carrying two bags. One is white and is filled with household trash. The other is yellow, and she places it inside a curbside container labeled food waste. This kind of recycling is called throw-as-you-go. You buy the food waste bags at grocery stores and toss them out after they're filled up. The bigger the bag, the more it costs. Kim, who's 29 and lives alone, says she just needs the smallest size, which costs 7 cents.
I usually throw away food waste once a week.
Do you cook at home a lot?
Not really. Sometimes I take some delivery food, so the leftovers.
In South Korea, food waste recycling is the law, and you can be fined hundreds of dollars for not separating your leftovers from ordinary garbage. Kim says it can be inconvenient, especially in the summer when the rotting food attracts bugs. But she knows she's doing the right thing for the environment, even though she's not really sure how it all works. At recycling facilities across Korea, machines grind up the food waste and dehydrate it, and then turn it into fertilizer and animal feed. Gas emissions become biofuel. Environmentalists call this a closed-loop system. Government figures show that about 98% of food waste is recycled here, and most South Koreans see it as a kind of civic duty to participate, according to Kim Mi-hwa, who heads the Korea Zero Waste Movement Network. That's because they're the ones who pushed for it, she explains. In 1996, some communities began calling on the government to do something about the traffic, insects, and the smell coming from garbage dumps, Kim says. Parents kept their kids out of school and protested. That pressure led to a 2005 law that banned disposing food in landfills, and the authorities worked with environmental groups to create the recycling program. It's a success story, she says, but maybe too successful? It turns out these facilities produce more feed and fertilizer than can actually be used, according to Kim. Some of it gets sold and shipped abroad. That's because 11 billion pounds of food still gets wasted every year, even if the path it takes has changed. So now the government is trying something different. It wants households to cut down on how much food they get rid of in the first place. In January, Seoul started a pilot program that rewards participants who reduce their waste with eco-mileage points. These can be used to pay for things like public transportation or buy energy-saving products. The data on how much food garbage households cut down on month to month gets sent back to the city through a network of smart trash cans. Already, there are around 27,000 of these units in Seoul, including one outside of Kim Hyunjin's building. She shows me how it works. First, she scans a radio frequency card that's registered to her apartment across a scanner on the front of the bin. The lid opens. Kim empties a bag of kitchen scraps into the container. The weight of her deposit appears on a screen.
200g이고요.
She scans her card again, and the lid closes. The cost is added to her monthly apartment maintenance fee. Kim hasn't signed up for the eco-mileage points, but she thinks the incentives could work.
네, 그런 리워드가 있다면 저는 당연히 좀 더 노력할 것 같고요.
I've seen similar awards programs like this before, she says, like one to lower your gas bill. It motivated me to use less. She says her monthly food waste bill is around 35 cents. Environmental advocate Kim Miwa says she supports the awards program, but she suggests that increasing recycling fees might make a bigger difference. To really solve South Korea's food waste problem, Kim says, requires a cultural change.
한국 사람의 그 이제 한국 사람들의 문화가 좀 손이 크다라고 이야기 좀 많이.
We always prepare more food than we need, Kim says. Traditionally, we make a lot of dishes and keep them in the refrigerator. If households bought just enough ingredients for their daily meals, there'd be fewer leftovers, and less food would get tossed out, even if it does get recycled. For The World, Jason Strother, Seoul.
Ahead on the show, how people living in African countries are getting lured into fighting for Russia in its war in Ukraine, and the latest headlines from the war in the Middle East. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Last week, Ghana's foreign minister said at least 55 Ghanaians have died fighting in Russia's war on Ukraine. Last month in Kenya, the government announced that more than 1,000 of their countrymen were recruited to fight for Russia and that 89 had died. Across the continent, there are similar accounts of Africans who have fought in Ukraine over the past 4 years of war. Exact numbers are a bit unclear, but Ukraine estimates that over 1,700 people from the African continent are actively serving today with the Russian military. One of them, 35-year-old Francis Ndarua, had a warning for others not to travel to Russia.
Be careful, you guys, because people are being taken there, and you end up being taken to the military, and you are taken in the front line.
That video message was shared with his mother last December, according to CNN. Another video of Ndarua was shared widely online.
What is your name?
Francis.
It shows him with what appears to be a landmine strapped to his chest. A Russian speaker off camera swears at him, uses racist language, and then moves him down a dark hall at gunpoint, saying he's going to be used as a, quote, can opener against the Ukrainians. Kunle Adebajo has been following what's going on. He's the editor of the African Academy for Open Source Investigations and joined the show from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
What we know about Francis' story was he did not intend to join the Russia-Ukraine war. His hope was to go to Russia and get a job as an electrical engineer. He traveled, I think, sometime around August 2025. And as we understand, the last time his mom heard from him was about 2 months later in October. And then, just like you said, these two videos surfaced on the internet. First was one of him warning other Africans not to fall for the same gimmick that he fell for, and then the other one that showed what was possibly moments before he passed.
That's indeed what happened. He was killed.
Yes, I don't think it's been confirmed for certain, but I mean, it's been incommunicado since that incident, so it's presumed dead, I believe.
Right. So you said he was hoping to become an electrical engineer. Are you saying that you think he was duped, told that he was going to be that engineer, but then was taken to the military?
Yes, and it's not an isolated incident. So many accounts of people who have ended up in the front lines also indicate that they thought they were traveling to Russia for other things. Some people thought they were going to be truck drivers or working at factories, or working as translators or security jobs and so on. Even though some knew that the job had something to do with military operations, they also did not expect that they would be involved in active combat roles.
Did he have any combat experience before joining the Russian forces?
He did not.
So how is Russia actually recruiting these soldiers?
Well, there are lots of pathways. As with Francis, some people are lured by recruitment networks and travel agencies in Africa who promise Russian citizenship, thousands of US dollars in monthly salary, and many other benefits. All they have to do is maybe serve in the military for 1 year or some other jobs that were promised forcefully, right? But then there are also other pathways like the use of influencers and ambassadors, the use of job adverts on social media. We've also had Africans who were recruited from the prison in Russia. Some people were arrested for different crimes like drug peddling, for example.
So you're saying Africans who migrated previously to Russia, who might have committed a crime there in prison, now they're being recruited?
Yes. Many of them, unfortunately, ended up being killed. We've also had cases of undocumented migrants also being offered this same opportunity to serve in the military as a way to easily get naturalized in Russia.
The video that we heard earlier with Francis Ndarwa, it would suggest some of these recruits are being used as cannon fodder, and listening to that very troubling video in a clearly racist context. How exceptional is that case?
We've not similarly graphic video come to light since then. The other one that also circulated around the same time was a video of a Russian soldier filming African conscripts from Eastern Africa, from places like Uganda and Kenya, who were chanting a morale-boosting song and then narrating behind the scene that, oh, now they are singing a happy song, but very soon when they get sent to the front lines, they will be singing a different tune, which was also reflecting the sort of dehumanizing way that the Africans are being viewed, which probably translates into how they are being treated as very expendable parts of the forces.
Your own research looked at 60 individuals from across Africa lured to fight for Russia. Where else other than Kenya and Ghana are they coming from?
Some of the most targeted countries were Egypt, Ghana, Cameroon, Gambia, Algeria. We've also seen so many cases from Kenya, Nigeria, and South Africa. Like I said, it's a very far-reaching and widespread thing that's going on.
Have any of the Africans who've been recruited, have they pleaded to leave and return to their home countries once they're on the front line and they realize what's going on?
Oh, absolutely. We've had many cases of people deserting and surrendering to the Ukrainian authorities after realizing what was going on. We've had cases of people who escaped after they sustained some injuries and were taken to a hospital in St. Petersburg. And then they just knock out and found a way back to return to their countries. And so, yeah, and we've also seen many videos of people at the front lines asking for help, pleading with their own governments back home to find a way to get them repatriated back to their homeland.
What are African governments doing about this so far?
We've seen a few African governments releasing statements warning their citizens from embarking on this trip. For example, Nigeria, Togo, even though those statements usually do not, you know, specifically name Russia as being a party to this. We've seen Cameroon trying to discourage people from joining the Russian military service, especially because in Cameroon, a lot of the people targeted are actually members of the Cameroonian armed forces. And so it's having very dastardly impact on their own ability to protect themselves.
That was Kunle Adibajo of the African Academy for Open Source Investigations.
At the top of the show, we reported on how the war with Iran has expanded far beyond the Middle East. Let's catch up on some of the impacts of that widening war.
The war in Ukraine is part of the conversation around Iran. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says the U.S. and allies are seeking Ukrainian expertise to fight Iran's Shahed drones. Russia has fired tens of thousands of the Iranian drones at Ukraine since their invasion just over 4 years ago. And Zelensky has said, essentially, help us fight Russia and we'll show you how to defend against Iran's firepower.
President Trump says he should be involved in choosing Iran's next supreme leader. Mojtaba Khamenei is the son of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who was killed in the opening strikes of the war. He is a frontrunner to be the next supreme leader, but Trump ruled him out in an interview with Axios. Trump's comments fuel the belief that the U.S. and Israel want to overthrow the regime of the Islamic Republic.
Iran is blockading the waterway used to ship 20% of the world's oil, so no surprise oil prices are rising. This afternoon, a barrel was at $85.22. That's up from close to $70 late last week before the attack on Iran. Analysts say if oil prices spike like to $100 per barrel and stay there, it could be too much for the global economy to withstand.
Go to theworld.org for more in-depth reporting on this quickly changing situation.
You're listening to The World.
The This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Scrambling up the side of a mountain, tracing the path of a receding glacier is unfortunately not my average day at the office. But for Paul Salopek, a National Geographic explorer walking across much of the world, it is all in a day's work. Paul recently huffed and puffed his way up a mountain in Alaska to learn about how the permafrost melting under his feet and the glacier receding alongside him would eventually trigger a massive landslide. Paul joins me now to talk about that. Paul, when you were not hallucinating from exhaustion, as you write, you were you were learning about that connection between melting permafrost and glaciers and landslides. What is that connection?
Yeah, it was something new to me. It's something called a geohazard. Mountains, you know, tear themselves down all the time through millions of years of erosion. But apparently what's happening is that with the climate crisis, the human-made climate crisis accelerating around the world, these colder parts of the world where there are vertical slopes, you know, mountains in the Arctic and in very high altitudes where there are glaciers, the glaciers are starting to melt, the permafrost is starting to thaw, and then you add in, you know, increased rains. Instead of snowing, it's raining, so it creates more runoff. And then seismicity, right? Earthquakes. All is leading to an increase in landslides across the world, anywhere where these conditions. Yeah.
You write that these warming trends that melt the glacial ice and permafrost, they are melting those things that once glued mountainsides in place. I thought that was a helpful image. And this is happening all around the world. Can you tell us what this has looked like in recent years in other places?
Yeah, one of the places where actually it has the greatest threat to human life is what scientists call the third pole. We all know about the North Pole and the South Pole. But the third pole is the Himalayas, the Himalayan, the highest mountains in the world. They have lots of glaciers, and therefore they're highly vulnerable to this phenomenon. And they're, you know, relatively highly populated. The highlands of northern India, for example, hundreds and hundreds of people every year die from landslides. Mm. Now there, it's not maybe always, you know, melting glaciers. It could be the fact that snow isn't falling and you've got torrential rains weakening the sides of mountains. But this is indeed a global phenomenon, and it's getting worse.
I'm recalling that Swiss village that was evacuated, I think maybe sometime last year, thankfully prior to a massive landslide there, but that was just a ton of earth moving down the side of that mountain.
Very dramatic. I remember there's footage that appeared online, and basically there was the same thing, Carolyn. You have glaciers are rivers of ice, and they're hemmed in by peaks, right, by mountains. They're basically flowing down the sides of very high peaks and into valleys. And when those mountainsides, which have sometimes been frozen for thousands of years, right, since the last glaciation, when they melt, they start actually shearing off and collapsing. What happened in Switzerland is that occurred. A mountain crumbled on top of an already weakened glacier, and it basically collapsed the glacier, which then went rumbling down and obliterated a town, a village.
So this brings us to your latest dispatch. You hiked up this mountain along the edge of a receding glacier with a geologist who was studying this. Let's start by having you take us there. What was that hike like?
Basically, to get to the site, I was walking with a geologist named Brentwood Higman. To get to the site where he and his colleague could, you know, implant basically motion sensors to try to start prototyping an early warning system. We had to paddle about, I think, 6 kilometers, you know, something like 4 miles across a glacial lake that was very choppy, blown by icy winds blowing off this glacier. We had to stash our extra gear on a cliffside with ropes to keep them out of the reach of grizzly bears. And then we had to climb almost a vertical kilometer up the sides of this very steep scarp, carrying heavy loads of, you know, scientific equipment in our backpack. And that's where I mentioned, it's like I was not just huffing and puffing. I thought I was going to be murdered by gravity. And this geologist, Higman, was like, he was just bouncing up there like a doll sheep.
Yeah, you paint him as quite the character, nimble as an acrobat, I think you say. But tell us more about the research he's doing. You say, you know, embedding these sensors up high in the mountains. What could they eventually tell us about the seismic activity in those mountains? I mean, does it ramp up before a landslide in a predictable way?
Basically, the way it was explained to me is that you can see tremors increase, you know, the frequency of them start to increase. And that doesn't tell you exactly when it may happen. And Higg, you know, he was very plain. He said, Paul, some of these things have been hanging in kind of suspended animation for centuries, mm-hmm. and others kind of surprise us. They happen behind our back, and we don't have it down yet, the science of predicting it. It's complicated. Another way, other than motion sensors, is subsonic sound, which is kind of cool. Some scientists have implanted listening devices into the sides of mountains, and they emit sounds that can't be heard by the human ear that kind of increase in frequency up until slightly before the mountain collapses. Then it goes kind of dead silent for this ominous period before the mountain slides down. So they're trying different technologies to kind of give human beings a little bit of a warning that a catastrophe is about to happen.
It does feel rather poetic to actually try to be listening to the mountains to try to understand this all better, listening to see what nature has to tell us.
Absolutely. I think we're just going to have to become more alert as the world shifts under our feet, in this case, literally. I, as I mentioned in my story, we camped out up on top of the ridge that was cracking, and there are these huge cracks. You can see the roots of plants being stretched taut across these cracks. That's how quickly it's moving. And you know, we slept in sleeping bags on top of the tundra, and I just remember putting my ear to that, even though I knew I couldn't listen. It was like putting my ear to the patient, to the chest of a patient who had some terminal illness.
Has your thinking about climate change changed at all since you saw those things up close?
You know, I've been seeing evidence of pretty dramatic climate change for the last 13 years on my walking project. Everything from places getting drier to places getting wetter. I think climate change is pretty much everywhere. It's global and indisputable. So this was just the latest evidence in a dramatic way, kind of with a bang, that this is something we're going to have to start really getting used to in our lifetimes.
Coming to terms with uncertainty, even more so. That's National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek. He is tracing the path of human migration on a project called the Out of Eden Walk. He is currently in Alaska. Paul, thank you so much. It is always a pleasure to speak with you.
My pleasure too, Carolyn. Until next time.
You can see photos of the trek up that Alaskan glacier Paul was talking about and read all of Paul's dispatches online. That is at outofeden.nationalgeographic.org, or find a link at our website, which is a bit easier to remember, theworld.org.
Call me Ishmael. And so opens the great novel Moby Dick along the docks of the city of New Bedford, Massachusetts. New Bedford is known for whaling and fishing, going back to the days of author Herman Melville. As the city grew in the 1900s, it also became known for its vibrant fishing community of migrants from Portugal. A new podcast called Catching the Cod Father tells the story of one man who left Portugal for New Bedford in 1968 and began working in the fishing industry. By the 1980s, he was a multi-millionaire. Then the IRS came calling. Here's host Ian Koss with an excerpt from that story.
Carlos Rafael grew up in the Azores, a string of islands in the Atlantic that are maybe a quarter of the way to North America if you're coming from Europe. So way out there, and small enough that you have to really zoom in on the map in order to see them at all. The Azores are part of Portugal. And in the 1960s, when Carlos was a kid, Portugal was fighting colonial wars on several fronts, in Mozambique, in Angola, in Guinea. Carlos had friends who were drafted off their tiny island and sent abroad, who died in the jungle, fighting for a lost and distant cause, a pointless cause. His parents did not want that for their son, so they sent young Carlos to study at a monastery.
That's the way they would keep me off the military if I stay in a monastery.
I have to say, I mean, I've only known you for about an hour, but it's hard for me to picture you in a monastery.
All my friends says, what a hell of a priest you would have made. But once my sister, she told me dad has an American passport.
Carlos's dad had an American passport. This revelation is not entirely surprising in a place where lots of families move back and forth to the U.S., but it was news to Carlos, infuriating news, because it meant his dad had an easy out all along and was so comfortable in his island life, he just didn't want to take it and instead sent his son to a monastery.
I freaked out. I said, oh, yeah, we're going to America. He says, you know, you're not going to America because you stayed in a monastery. That's where they put you here. So I did, so they could throw me out.
Every night, the priests in training would have dinner, then go to prayer, and by 9:30, they'll go up to their dormitory.
So everybody went up to the dorm. I went to the football field and I jumped the fence and I took off.
Carlos didn't care about actually getting away with this little escape act. He wanted to get caught. He wanted to get punished.
Didn't go too far. I went for a walk until I was about a quarter of 11 when I come back. I jumped the fence and I come back in. Well, little I know that the priest was upstairs waiting for me. He says, you'll be your next bell tomorrow. I'm calling your parents and we're shipping you back home.
Now Carlos would find out if his gambit paid off. It looked like either way he was leaving the Azores. Could be for the U.S., could be for Angola. Which one was up to his father?
So I was terrified to get home. I said, he's going to beat the living crap out of me. My father says, I'm going to teach you a lesson. We're not going anyplace. He's the one. He was in the right place. He should have stood there and all that. But there was my mother. She every day would be humming at him. And she says, you know what's going to happen? If he goes, he'll probably come in the coffin.
Carlos was 15 at this point. At 16, he would register for the draft.
So after she keep battling and battling, they decide to come here.
So you got out just before your 16th birthday?
I got it in March. June would have been too late.
Carlos boarded a TWA flight and followed the same route across the sea that people from the Azores had taken for generations to the small coastal city of New Bedford, Massachusetts. The flight attendant gave him a little set of plastic wings he could pin on his shirt. He was proud of those wings, proud to be starting fresh, proud to be in America, finally free.
When I arrived in the United States in 1968, I always said to myself, I am not going to be working for anybody else all my life. I'm going to do this for myself.
And it turned out that Carlos was arriving at the right time. A time of crisis, actually, for the industry that defined New Bedford. But as Carlos himself has told me, a crisis, now that is when you can make a lot of money. And Carlos Rafael would do just that.
Throughout the world, New Bedford, Massachusetts is best known as the whaling city.
New Bedford, as you may know, is the port that inspired Moby Dick and where the author, Herman Melville, set out on his own whaling voyage.
The first whale ship, the Dartmouth, sailed out of this port.
But if you stepped off a boat there in the 1960s, when Carlos arrived and wandered into the neighborhoods along County Street or Rivet Street, you'd find a very different world from the one Melville knew.
That entire area was all Portuguese.
Maria Tomasia, like Carlos Rafael, came to New Bedford from the Azores.
It's like every island or every town had their own club. You know, there's the Ponta Delgada Club, there's the Fial Club, there's the Medeiros Club, there's the Fisherman Club, Central Luso Club, Rocco da Sonja Club. So everybody had their place to socialize.
There were two Portuguese newspapers. There was a Portuguese radio station, a dedicated Portuguese library with over 3,000 titles in it. This was the capital of Portuguese North America. The Portuguese immigration here started in the Moby Dick era, the middle of the 1800s. Whaling ships out of New Bedford would stop in the Azores and Cape Verde to pick up supplies. People got on board as well, and then more people followed, and more people.
And they saw there was a fishing industry. You lived by the water. You just, you know, once you live by the water, it's very difficult to go anyplace else and not see that water.
By 1970, Massachusetts was home to one-third of all Portuguese immigrants in the entire country, and most of those people were clustered in the coastline near New Bedford. Within the fishing industry itself, there's actually an interesting ethnic divide, historically at least. For many years, the scallop boats tended to be run by Norwegian immigrants, But the draggers, the boats that went after bottom fish like cod and flounder, they were overwhelmingly Portuguese, 80 to 90% by one estimate. And in the 1970s, when Carlos was still new in town, those fishermen were in trouble.
I would be mostly as a translator.
The man the fishermen went to for help was Maria Tomasia's boss, New Bedford Congressman Gary Studs.
They were concerned about the fact that, you know, there were other people out there.
Other people out there. Other people competing for the same cod, haddock, and flounder off the coast of New England, but with bigger boats, bigger nets. What the fishermen described was a foreign invasion.
That's how they would talk about it. They felt that they were taking away what was theirs.
Okay, coming up, we've got a Russian midwater trawler. It's about 12 and a half miles off the coast.
It's a little hard to imagine now, but in the 1970s, foreign fishing boats could come as close as 12 miles off the coast, and they could catch whatever they wanted. This audio is from a Coast Guard flyover just off Cape Cod.
Okay, this is a Bulgarian.
There were German boats, Russian, Spanish, Japanese, all drawn to the rich coastal waters of New England. And because they were so far from port, these ships were essentially floating factories. They filleted, froze, or canned the fish right on board, working for months at a time on a massive scale.
Probably averaging somewhere in the neighborhood of, say, 35 to 40 tons a day.
I used to see miles and miles and miles of these ships. They looked like big cruise ships.
Rodney Avila was a young fisherman at the time, just starting out.
And I used to say, I'm going to have no fish when I grow up.
Modern trawling techniques are sweeping everything from the sea.
This foreign presence really ramped up over the 1960s, so that by the mid-70s, if you looked at the total catch on New England's very best fishing grounds, 90% of it was pulled up by foreign boats. 90%. And the fishermen and scientists alike could see the effects.
Like the haddock had already disappeared. The bottom fish has all disappeared. The fluke has all disappeared.
And that's how the whole thing came into being, is that they wanted something done about it.
That's an excerpt from the podcast Catching the Codfather from GBH and PRX. There's more in the six-part series Catching the Codfather. Listen wherever you listen to podcasts. And while you're at it, be sure to subscribe to our podcast, The World, also from GBH and PRX. We'll be right back. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. There is an art exhibition in Prague, the capital of the Czech Republic, that's causing a good deal of consternation. It details the political struggle for cultural expression in neighboring Slovakia under the populist government of current Prime Minister Robert Fico. The title of the exhibit is Free National Gallery, Description of a Struggle, and documents the dismissals, resignations, strikes, and standoffs as Slovakia's renowned National Gallery in Bratislava was steadily brought under political control. From Prague, DW's Rob Cameron reports.
The scene at Bratislava's Slovak National Gallery in September last year, ahead of the opening of an exhibition of modern Slovak art called Bang Bang. The exhibition was met by protests because the artworks were being displayed without the consent of their creators. The gallery said that as the owner of the works, it had the right to exhibit them as it saw fit. It was the latest installment in what has widely been described as chaos at the National Gallery since former TV presenter Martina Šimkovičová, an MP for the far-right Slovak National Party, who shot to fame on YouTube spreading conspiracy theories about COVID, was put in charge of Slovakia's culture ministry in 2023. Šimkovičová said she wanted official Slovak culture to better represent what she called traditional Slovak values, rather than work that explored liberal or LGBTQ plus themes. Within her first few months in office, she'd sacked the heads of the Slovak National Library and the Slovak National Theatre. Alexandra Kusar had been the Slovak National Gallery's director for 14 years until she signed a letter in support of her fellow directors. She, too, was promptly fired.
First, they said it was because the gallery was empty. Then, because it was too full. Then, it was because there was no flag outside the building. Then, something to do with renovation. They never said the real reason, that they simply didn't want to work with us, which is a shame, because it was the truth. But it was also impossible to work with them, too. They're not interested in cooperation. They're not even interested in culture. They have this feudal idea of management. My person, your person. You can't work with someone like that. It's another universe. It's not even a matter of having a different opinion about culture. They're living in a different universe.
That is almost literally true. The culture ministry official behind the changes is famous for telling an interviewer that because he hadn't been into space, he couldn't say for sure whether the Earth is round. After Kusar's sacking, more than 100 curators and other staff quit. The vast majority of artists refused to allow their work to be shown. Many of the rooms are empty. Major exhibitions have been cancelled. International partners have withdrawn. It is, in Alexandra Kusar's words, a house of ghosts.
Where you officially enter the exhibition.
Last summer, activists set up a symbolic protest space next door, the Free National Gallery, in direct opposition to the Slovak National Gallery. Detailing all that is a new exhibition at the Prague City Gallery called Free National Gallery, Description of a Struggle.
Architecture and building up the new.
It was this our relationship with the Slovak creators.
The gallery's director, Magdalena Južíková, says what's happened in Slovakia carries a clear warning for other countries, including here in the Czech Republic, where a conservative populist government took power in January. The ministry's remit in both countries extends to the national broadcasters. In Slovakia, critics say that institution has already been gutted and brought to heel. Public TV and radio here in the Czech Republic is still regarded as mostly free from political interference, for now.
Why we do this exhibition? To show that all that things are happen very quickly, rapidly, and the open society is under the pressure. Nobody knows what will happen because we are only a few months under this government. So, but there are problems with the financing of public TV and radio, so those are the first steps. Yeah.
Recently, Slovakia's culture minister Martina Šimkovičová visited Prague, part of a gradual thawing of relations under Czech Prime Minister Andrej Babiš after a chilly few years. She met her Czech counterpart Otto Klempíš, who caused some alarm by telling reporters afterwards that the Slovaks were ahead of the Czechs in reforming their funding of public media, saying she'd advised him on what pitfalls to avoid. He's previously defended the Czech license fee. It's now unclear for how much longer. This is Rob Cameron in Prague.
Rob's story first aired on the DW podcast, Inside Europe. Katrin Finch is from Wales and since childhood has played the national instrument of her country, the harp. She is known for her collaborations, but her newest recording is a solo project. It features recent works that Finch, now in her 40s, composed and dedicated to her 13-year-old self. The songs on Notes to Self are built around letters that Finch wrote to Katie, as she was known as a girl. They provided the inspiration for her music.
Dear Katie, she writes in one of her letters, I know it is very hard to imagine that one day everything that currently fills your mind with worry will fade away. This is a more intimate sound for Catherine Finch. She's performed with Irish fiddlers and with Senegalese kora players. That's a West African harp. There's no real way to put a descriptor on the kind of music she makes. Finch told the Classical Next Festival a few weeks ago that she's not even sure that matters.
Even in the last decade, I think I found it really difficult to categorize the music I've been playing and you know, working with other people. But I think increasingly, actually, this idea of having to label music and having to box yourself into one category is becoming less and less relevant.
In other words, just listen and appreciate the sound for what you hear, not what it's called. The last line to one of those letters Catherine Finch wrote to her 13-year-old self also is a reminder to appreciate what's right in front of us. You won't realize it now, she tells Katie, but time is the one thing that you will never get back.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. We are online even when we are not on the air at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
Is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Piggott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.